How am I communicating as a leader? Is this being effective or not effective? So your continuous improvement effort should be self-funding. No fair for the leader to be standing on the side of the pool showing us all how to swim, right? You got to get in the water. You got to be involved in problem solving that's applicable at your level.
Welcome back to KPI Fireside, a continuous improvement podcast. If this is your first time listening in, welcome. We're super happy to have you join us. Our mission here is simple, to improve companies and improve careers through continuous improvement. We're here to share inspiring stories and journeys from individuals who've embarked on this path of continuous improvement. Through these interviews with leaders and innovators and change makers, we explore the sparks that ignite transformative journeys both within organizations and in personal and career growth. So whether you're just starting out or looking to take your improvement efforts to the next level, this podcast is here to guide you, inspire, and empower you. I am your host, Keith Norris, and our guest today is Ted Iverson. Ted is the managing director at ICG and a veteran transformation leader. He's a former McKinsey expert, a longtime Shingo Prize examiner, and has helped organizations around the world from oil and gas to healthcare achieve enterprise excellence through lean engagement and purpose-driven change. So welcome, Ted. So happy to have you join us.
Thanks, Keith. Appreciate the invite.
You bet. Where are you at today?
I live just outside of Boise, Idaho. So travel quite a bit. So matters less where I live, but this is always my favorite place to travel. So home.
Now, that's awesome. It's probably starting to get a little warm up there this time of year.
It is. We're expected to be nice and toasty later this week.
And maybe getting up to what, 60, 70 degrees Fahrenheit?
Yeah, a lot of times we are that way, but this week it's going to be up in the 80s. So
good.
That's cooking.
Awesome. Well, we like to start our podcast with a little conversation about what we call the spark. And what I find a lot of times there's folks in this industry, this discipline, that there was maybe a moment that they remember or something about how they got their start in this discipline. For you, was there a particular experience or moment that you recall? How did you get started in this?
Definitely. So hate to say the time frames, right? But in the mid 80s, I was working in commercial aircraft, helping start up a new facility for McDonnell Douglas. It was in Salt Lake City, Utah. There was a general manager there at the time, a guy named Al Egbert. I had responsibility. We'd grown through several iterations, and I had responsibility for some fabrication areas and some small sub-assembly areas in the stock rooms. And he said, you know what? He said, the Japanese are kicking our butts in the automotive industry. And he said, you're gonna learn what they're doing, and you're going to help us apply it to commercial aircraft. And so he sent me out to some places to learn, and I came back and I said, Al, I said, I don't think this is going to work, and I don't want to do it. And he did not listen to a word I said. He completely held my feet to the fire, held me accountable, forced me to change things. We did things so different. I mean, we had to change the way we measured success for managers and leaders and all those things, and literally in that process changed the way I saw the world. Changed my entire career with that experience. And I owe it to him, as do many other people that grew up in that company at that time. There are several of us that were so impacted by Al Egbert and the things that he forced us to do in a very friendly and thoughtful way, but very aspirational. So
I love that. It sounds like having a good mentor to encourage you in the right direction. You know, like a lot of things in life, sometimes it's not like our choosing, I guess you could say, but it does seem like you've made this somewhat of your life's work. I know that you were working with McKinsey, probably a few things in between there. Maybe tell us about a few of the, kind of highlights or lowlights of your journey from McDonnell Douglas to where you're at today.
Sure. We did good things at McDonnell Douglas at the time. It was phenomenal people working there. We did some, kinds of things where people said, I don't think that's true. And so they'd come and they'd visit us, and we had good streams of people coming to visit. And, it was stuff like new product or new part introduction from 45 weeks to 2 weeks, and where we went from two inventory turns to 30 plus inventory turns. And, those kinds of things that were happening. And so people, regularly would come to visit. And I thought I'd build airplanes the rest of my life. So that was the plan, until one of those companies that came to visit asked if I would come and help them do the same thing at their site, which was medical equipment. Had good successes there, got asked to go into a farm equipment company and then a food production company. And then people started asking for help. And so I'd go and help them. And, in those days, And probably nowadays, too, the word consultant is the nasty C word, you know. And people would say, oh, you're a consultant. I'd say, no, actually, because I wear boots and jeans and we go do stuff. We don't just talk about it. And so I always describe myself as a teacher and helper. But gradually, I've accepted that word consultant. I had my own business for quite a while. And then a little over a decade ago, McKinsey called and asked if I would join. And I told them, no, I don't want to be part of a large consulting firm. And they took me to five different offices and conducted interviews. And I had the chance to interview them, too. And I thought, you know, there are some things I can learn here with these people. And there were some just phenomenal people inside that organization that, you know, are still very good, close connections and friends. And so I just finished a decade with them. I separated last year. Back on my own again, doing my own thing, because there were some things that we did well at McKinsey. And you know, like in 2023, we had a couple of Shingo Prize winners, which is, that's why they called me to start with. They were collecting Shingo Prize examiners at the time. And this is my 30th year as a Shingo Prize examiner. For those of you who know, Shingo is kind of the global standard on operational excellence. And if you believe you're the best of the best, you can take your 3 years worth of solid benchmark level improvement, put it into an achievement report, tell people about the highly engaged culture that you have. And if they award you a site visit, then a team of examiners comes and provides feedback so you can keep getting better and better. And the recognition of winning either a prize or a silver or bronze recognition. And they must have been hurting for talent early, you know, because they asked me to become an examiner in 1995 they haven't kicked me out yet. But that's why McKinsey called. They were collecting those folks at the time and had a good team of people there. But there are some things I wanted to do, especially related to technology and large organizations. When you work with 90 or 150,000 people, you know, 90,000 or 150,000, how do you get all of that capability way out into the organizations? How do you do it in a timely manner? You know, you can build these big central teams, or you can, you know, come up with all kinds of programs, but then you've got to sustain it because everybody moves every 3 years, right? And so, you know, sustaining those gains and really creating that culture, some things I wanted to try. So I still serve them as an external advisor. I still support them, but have the opportunity to do things that are new and challenging and a little bit more innovative.
So Ted, some really interesting stuff there. I would love to hear a little bit more about it's going back a while, your relationship with the Shingo organization. I would assume that I know that they just had a conference that you were involved with. I saw something online about a section of that you did. I think it had something to do with horses.
Yeah, we did. In fact, that's one of those things I tried to get going at McKinsey, a different approach to learning leadership. And it came about just most of my adult life, I've had horses at my home and property. And we're not fancy riders in our family. We're trail riders. And if you stay on the horse, you're good. So there are a lot of folks that are, you know, much better technical riders than our group. But I noticed as I taught grandkids how to ride horses, that a lot of the same counsel that I gave them was also the similar counsel that I'm giving to leaders as they guide their organizations through these massive transformations in the way we work. You know, how do you position yourself in that seat of leadership? How do you send clear messaging and signals about pace and direction? How do you anticipate what's coming in the future? And what, you know, a horse is a large and powerful organization with a mind of its own, ears and heart and past experience of its own. And so it comes with a set of biases that the leader has to understand about in order to effectively cooperate with the horse. And you look at history too, and until the last 100 years, you know, you can go back several thousand years before that, and most significant leaders had experience with horses. Right? Whether you're looking at Napoleon, whether you're looking at Alexander the Great, whether you're looking at George Washington, it doesn't matter. You look at all of those and they had that. So they understand the cooperative nature that happens between the leader and the powerful organization. And in the last 100 years, I think some of that learning has been lost. And horses are just an easy way to get instant feedback about how am I communicating as a leader? Is this being effective or not effective? Anyway, we've developed this program, half-day intro, which is great. We talk about the seven building steps of that relationship when you're developing the horse-rider relationship, and we relate that to leadership. And then we have a full day building confidence, and then it gets capped off with the big event is a three-day pack trip into the Idaho wilderness, two overnights. And so you get the experience of truly leading the horse with variables and that really just deep personal learning about your leadership style and your ability to observe what's happening and respond appropriately.
Interesting. I love how you're, that's one thing that I find really interesting about this discipline generally is how we think about operational excellence or continuous improvement as this thing that you do at work. But so many of these lessons are so applicable in so many areas of life. I mean, you talk about leadership and you used examples from grandchildren or members of your family. I mean, there's just so much of these lessons that can be used in other ways.
For sure. I think about them as pieces of truth, right?
Yeah.
These are pieces of truth. And regardless of where you are and what you're doing, the question is, how do I take what I know is true and how do I apply it in this setting? And you continue to discover more of those pieces of truth and how they work, and that assembly makes it something magical.
I love that, pieces of truth. That's such a good insight, because I think, you know, when you think about this, I get this practice of operational excellence or continuous improvement. You know, sometimes you've got things that you know, people have different levels of passion, I guess you could say, about things like lean and this discipline. How do you explain it to somebody who might not be like a disciple of lean, but just maybe an outsider as an introduction to what this work is that you do?
Yeah. So our take on that and our push is a little bit different, right? It's very much in harmony with what Shingo teaches, which is, you know, why I've chosen to kind of stay on that side. And yet I find people globally who have like learn those same pieces of truth and applied it. And then later they've heard about Shingo and it's like, oh my gosh, it's like the brother from another mother kind of thing. And all of a sudden I know and I relate to people because we've discovered the same things in totally independent ways. But the scenario is with our approach, I think lean has the wrong current image, especially in North America. Globally, there's a little bit different perspective. Honestly, my last 6 or 7 years has been almost exclusively international, very little in North America, and I'm trying to get re-domesticated, but because I'm tired of international travel, but it's amazing things happening. It's not so much the cost reduction that so many people apply right now. And even I'll go controversial enough to say it's not so much about waste elimination. It's more about knowing how to add value quicker, faster, easier, better, and it creates a growth platform for the organizations. And they can grow however they choose, right? It could grow within the value chain, can grow horizontal to other industries, you know, serving in that same kind of space or product, you know, excellence or service excellence. But it's within that scope, it's finding the good that your organization does and connecting that purpose then to specific strategic goals, and then using your continuous improvement system to achieve those goals and achieve that purpose, and then illustrating it very directly. So, you know, if you're in healthcare, that works really well. You got a purpose that's right up there and connected at the top. If you're doing French fries, it's not quite so clear what the purpose might be. Or in mining, where I've spent a lot of time in the last 6 or 7 years. So in mining, as an example, when we look at that purpose, it might be to, and I've got one client now that their purpose basically boils down to build a better world. And so the question is, how am I building a better world through my continuous improvement practices? I can connect at the top of that and I can see all of the great things the organization does, but down at lower levels in the organization, it has to be real. And for me to have passion, if I'm a frontline worker, for me to have passion and heartfelt engagement, I've got to feel that connection. I've got to know how important my job is and that I'm not just making bricks, I'm actually building the cathedral. Kind of thing, right?
All right, Ted, I want to come back to something that you said about the misuse or the potential misuse of lean in the Americas currently. Drill down on that thought for a minute.
Yeah. So a lot of folks, and even consultants especially, you know, they go for the numbers, you know, what percentage, how much can we cut costs? How much can we? In my opinion, cutting cost is the absolute lowest form of consulting you can do. anybody can cut costs, right? Anybody can show improvement over the next 1, 3, you know, 6 quarters kind of stuff, because some of those things don't have impact right away. And so unfortunately, the way that some of our advancement and recognition systems work, you have some executives that move from place to place, cutting costs, supported by consultants that cut costs, and then somebody else has to respond to, we took out all of these infrastructure systems and now things are falling apart, that it's not sustainable, right? And it's also a little bit like the lean kind of thing. We get so hooked on waste that we forget what is value. And not all, one of my very good friends and mentors, John Kim, is the one who first said, not all waste is created equal. There are some types of waste that are so much more valuable to eliminate than others. And unless you understand the customer side of the equation and how to delight and excite and engage the customer, whether it's a service you're offering or a product, unless you understand that, your lean is not going to be as powerful. And, you know, you can add theory of constraints in there too. So if I've got a constraint on a processing line, I can save money in all of those things. And yes, I am saving some money, but I'm not really increasing capacity unless I'm focused on that constraint and I'm gaining it. So you could, you know, sub-optimize all of the other areas and create things that look like they're benefiting the bottom line, when in fact, when you go to the bottom line, because they haven't resolved anything at the constraint, bottom line doesn't change, even though you say you've done all of these, you know, great improvements. So the cost reduction stuff, you know, if you have to do it short term, understand it's just a short term thing. But when people keep wondering why their lean and continuous improvement efforts don't sustain, it's because you can only tighten the screw so far. Right? You've got to find ways to add value quicker, faster, better, not just, you know, get by with less and less and less. It's kind of like putting the organization in a straitjacket and pretty soon you can't even breathe.
Yeah, it's interesting that lean has, I mean, the cost cutting part of lean, like you've got to show a benefit or a return on any investment in, you know, in the business world particularly. And it seems like the financial benefits are maybe the easiest ones to point to, but there's so many other benefits. I know that some people talk maybe more about cutting costs, eliminating waste, but more about creating capacity. Because if you cut the costs and then lose all the people that were your capacity, that's a different kind of problem. Yeah. I've seen some folks focus in on like that capacity metric, and then what do you do with that metric? I'm curious if you have some thoughts on how do you quantify the return on the investment other than just the cost saving, the cutting cost part?
Yeah, so it's definitely, I mean, cost is part of that. And I don't want to pretend that it's not, but it's not the primary objective. So I'm going to look at, you know, in the way we did originally, before the term lean came out, we talked a lot about other, you know, kinds of phrases, just in time, demand flow, and, you know, every generation has to demonize the last term so that they can write books and, oh, this is different. Well, not really. It's pretty much the same with a few new tools. But the way we look at that is can I reduce my throughput times and my cycle times from start to finish? Can I reduce my times? Because if I reduce my times, I'm getting more out with the same resources, right? That's productivity. That means I can add more in. And in a lot of manufacturing organizations, you have to look at it up front in a very macro sense and say, look, if operations is always dragging and behind because you've got quality issues, you've got hit the due date issues or any of that kind of stuff, when that all resolves, you're going to have extra capacity. And when you have that extra capacity, you have to be able to fill it up with something else. And the farm equipment company I talked about, we created 40% more capacity with existing resources. We introduced a whole nother product line with the existing resources and existing capital, right? No new stuff. And now all of a sudden you've got a 40% increase in revenue just because you were able to improve the throughput on the other areas, right? And those other value streams.
It seems like there's probably a direction in leadership or a direction in strategy when you do create capacity. Like let's say you reduce the cost. Now, I mean, one answer is, okay, we'll cut all those headcount that you used to be spending all that money on. The other answer might be do something with them. I'm curious if there's some, you know, a train of thought around like the leadership or the job of a leader that, how to use these, the capacity that you have that you might give us some insights on.
Yeah, absolutely. So the common short-term thinking that's evident in a lot of the large organizations is that if I can increase that capacity, I capture it all to the bottom line, I report it out, and we pay it out in dividends, or we take everything to the bottom line. That to me that's very short-sighted, right? And so I advocate that when we bring that to the bottom line, that we save a portion and we reinvest that in continuous improvement. You know, you take those winnings, you take that advantage and reinvest it in the organization. And so your continuous improvement effort should be self-funding, right? This is, and we want to, there is an initial time frame where you're putting some investment into it up front, creating the resources, creating the space. That is that leading indicator kind of stuff. But that lagging indicator where your KPIs are coming in better, that also creates the ability to self-fund all of the improvement efforts so that it's an investment that continues to grow and get better. But if you take every ounce to the bottom line, you're not giving yourself the opportunity to grow that investment.
I love that, what you just said there about your continuous improvement program system should be self-sustained. Did you say self-sustaining or self-funding?
Self-funding. Yeah.
Self-funding. Yeah. What would be maybe a model of how somebody could do that? I mean, you've got those savings. What are some other metrics that people should be reporting to maintain that support for their program so that it doesn't have to just be about the costs that they've cut? What other metrics might they use as part of their reporting of their program?
Yeah. So, spend can be something where costs, reducing spend and those kinds of things, that's a very financial metric. And of course, that fits right in. Overtime is another financial metric that you can look at that would, but overall, the numbers I'm looking for, and especially if I'm on a Shingo sighted exam, right, I'm looking for the global kinds of numbers. I want to know wall to wall, how much resource do we have compared to how much output are we generating? Right. So if I'm mining, it's tons of copper produced per labor hour. It's that kind of a metric. And you can drive that into labor hours in each one of the ones. It's the level of yield. How much did I produce versus the yield that I got through? Because if I can go a couple of percentage points up on yield, amazing things happen. And that creates, volume and capacity and reduces cost. In manufacturing environments, we're looking at that first time quality and all of those kinds of very traditional things. Some of the soft stuff, though, and especially nowadays where so many people are struggling with headcount, if I can reduce the turnover in an organization because of the culture that we develop, and it was in some of the workshops that I taught earlier this week, where we talk about how when you get all of the pieces moving in the right direction and you get those things all assembled, places where nobody wanted to work before, all of a sudden now it's magnetic. They're drawing people in, and they're not only just drawing people, they're drawing the right kind of talent to come into those organizations. And now it's like, there's a list of people wanting to get in here so I can choose the best people, I can bring them in. And that, again, builds the investment in what we can achieve and what we can do. My client down in Escondida, we talked to them about setting aspirational goals. And that's part of the cost-cutting kind of thing, right? As a leader in an organization, if I talk to them and I say, we need to improve everything by 3% or 6%, what happens is everybody looks at their existing operation and they say, okay, I can tighten the screws a little further. We can squeeze this in and we can get 3% or we can get 6%. And they do it by working harder at the existing process. And that's exactly what we don't want them to do, right? I do not want the sweatshop mentality. I don't want them working harder. I want it to be different. And so as leaders, we have to ask for that aspirational kind of thing. We have to ask for enough improvement that they look back at us and they say, there's no way we can do that. That is not possible. And our response as leaders should be, you're right, that's not possible the way we do it now. I do not want you to work harder. I want you to work different. And we enable them then to think, and I'm not asking for a bunch of capital equipment requests, right? I'm not asking for CapEx spending. Use creativity over capital. You hit the aspirational kinds of targets. If they set a goal, to go 1,000,000 miles and they only go 750,000, okay. That's fine. It's in that direction. But the aspirational goal then allows them to think differently. And I was fortunate to be a leader who worked in that situation, in that environment, where my leaders gave me goals that were so aspirational. They didn't know how to hit them. I didn't know how to hit them. We all had to work together in order to be able to figure that out. And too many organizations aren't doing that well. The one I was mentioning in Escondida, they set a goal for copper recovery that was beyond the technical limit of their equipment. And so engineers, equipment suppliers, all of that, they came back, they said, you'll never hit that goal. Your equipment is technically not capable of exceeding that yield. And one of the gentlemen who was in charge of maintenance came back to me about 3 months later, and he said, I knew we couldn't do it. And then we did.
How do you reconcile that period of time from when the goal feels like, these guys are crazy, there's no way we can do this, oh my gosh, if I don't hit this goal, I'm probably going to get fired, to, wow, we actually did this thing that was, you know, completely impossible.
Yeah.
How do you bridge that time period with the people?
It's a time when they need to be able to trust the leader, right? I'm not going to fire you if we don't make it, but we're going to make it, right? It's doing the most we can and expressing confidence and support and delegating decisions down to lowest possible level. You know, not decisions that are impacting quality or customer, or, you know, fit, form, or function, any of that stuff, but in how they do their work. It's being much more attentive to building that capability and that strength. And so, like in Escondida, they hit that level, and then they came back and they set the goal the next year to hit it even more, and they did that, right? And then corporate came back to them and said, this is great, man, you guys are awesome. Here's your goal for the third year. And these guys came back to him and they said, that goal's not high enough. And they set it again higher. And every time they've hit it, you know, and people in the corporation are looking at him and going, how are they doing that? That's like voodoo or something.
That's awesome. That's fun to be part of a team that has that sort of thing happening. I'm curious, it sounds like with your consulting experience and what you're doing right now, there's probably some lessons that you could share with folks where maybe the organization culture or the goal setting is leaning a certain direction, but there's some behaviors, some things where maybe you have to just trust that it's the right way. It sounded to me like maybe there's some experiences that you've had recently in that area. Maybe there's some behaviors that you could encourage people to, you know, you might not see it today, but have trust in this path.
Yeah. So a lot of it's when we talk about purpose of an organization, there are a lot of leaders who, you know, that resonates with, but they look at it and they say, you know, I need to be much more tactical. And I'm not saying because we focus on purpose doesn't mean we're not tactical, but our emphasis as leaders has to be a lot more about, let's focus on the good that we're doing and create patterns, ways of working that reinforce that good over and over and over again, so that when we get that higher yield, when we get that faster delivery, you know, the higher quality, we recognize the purpose and it inspires us because something amazing has happened. But then we also get that dopamine rush because we've solved a problem, we've achieved a goal. And honestly, it's getting the entire culture hooked on that kind of environment for working. So people say stuff like, I know it's different, but this is how we work here. And it's a good thing they pay me, because I'd probably do this for free, but they pay me because they like being there.
I love that, because you're touching on something that I believe that as humans, we would all prefer to work somewhere that is engaging, that is fun, where work feels more like play and like fun than it does purely like work. Now, not everybody's in that situation. And even those of us that are in that situation, some days it's not like that every day. But I do think that there is something about being able to have that sort of a culture. Are there any behavior patterns or specific like leadership behaviors that you've seen or that you can recommend as things that people can actually do to get more of that type of a culture versus?
Yeah. Definitely there are. And I'll maybe just give this one little reference point as to when I first started looking at this. Years ago, I had the opportunity to spend some time with a gentleman named Ralph Steyer. And Ralph Steyer was, I think, second or third generation leader of Johnsonville Foods, Johnsonville sausage, you know, those brats we love putting on the grill. And, you know, just a phenomenal man. And in spending time with him, he said something that has stayed with me all my life. And it dovetails into those leadership behaviors that we need to have in place. He said, our organization was doing well, and we had a pattern of promoting stars inside of our organization. These are the people who could get things done, the people who could solve problems, the people who could, you know, schedule themselves, drive performance, all of that kind of stuff, go the extra mile. He said, we promoted stars, and that's what we did. And he said, we did good. And then he said, I finally realized that behind every star, there was a star builder. And he said, the moment I started recognizing the star builders and then giving them more responsibility, more people to influence, he said, that's when amazing things started happening inside of our organization. And so as leaders, if we achieve this level of capability and performance and all of that kind of stuff, we have to recognize that our role changes. And if you become a star in your organization, you need to be able to move on to that next level and become the star builder so that people are following in those footpaths and becoming peers, not dependents. I'm going to build these people up to where we're collaborators and cooperating. And so some of the leaders have a hard time getting hold of that. And it looks like visiting them when they're doing their work. It looks like being on site and coaching, and we build that in through leader standard work that, you know, they have regular routines of looking at what is best practice and how can I help my people to grow and develop and you know, dedicating time to that.
You dropped a term there that I want to ask you to drill into, because maybe not everybody even knows what that means, but leader standard work.
Sorry. Yeah, I use that a lot. I'm a big fan. David W. Mann did some incredible work on that, and David has since passed. But he is really the father of leader standard work. And as lean practitioners, as manufacturing and industry professionals, and whether you're in the financial industry or whether in, you know, any of the processes, we all recognize there's a best way to perform a job, right? And we apply that a lot to the front line. But when we talk about leaders, there's also a best way to do my job, right? And I should be able to set that out and say, my best practice might look like this for the next month. I should be able to do these kinds of activities, these kinds of intervals. I should be in these places. And then I should be tracking myself against that optimum that I set up and seeing what my level of adherence is to what I said was best practice. And I should have that interval of visiting with my direct boss about that on that regular basis. Usually it's once a month. How am I doing? Ted, here's the things you could do better. Here's the things I observed that, you know, feedback, great on this stuff, opportunities here. And that we continue to help me work to what is best for my job and what is that leader standard work. And then I'll share this too, which is a secret that I think the rest of the industry hasn't connected to this. But if you set up your behaviors as a leader and categorize those, each of those behaviors, what am I intending for this behavior to produce? So if I have specific behaviors that are related to increasing safety, improving safety, if I have specific behaviors related to improving quality or behaviors related to building empowerment or culture inside of our organization, if I'm adhering to those behaviors and I contrast it with my KPI, if those two things don't trend in the same direction, high adherence to behaviors equals high performance on my KPI, I don't have the right behaviors in place. And I need to be able to calibrate my behaviors against the outcomes of the organization. And so if I have high adherence in my behaviors and my KPIs aren't going the right direction, I'm not doing the right stuff. I need to be doing something different. And so over time, you continue that iteration to be able to make sure that my behaviors are optimum for supporting my organization to achieve those kinds of outcomes that are expected.
Okay, Ted, I'm a great fan of leader standard work also, and as a leader myself, I'm always paying attention to mine and making adjustments to it. Are there certain behaviors, and you could use an industry example if you want, but are there certain behaviors that maybe are really critical to see as part of that leader standard work, or that sometimes you see left out that could make a difference for somebody that they might want to have in there?
I think it's, well, for leader standard work, right? We need to make sure that not only are the best practices defined, but we're holding ourselves accountable by tracking them. So my adherence to leader standard work is a big deal. I mentioned David W. Mann, who's kind of the father of leader standard work. That's the format that I use. Mine's a simple one-page Excel spreadsheet that, you know, nothing fancy, but it tracks
I got mine right
here. Oh, you got yours. Yeah, that's mine right there. We look about the same, right?
Yeah.
So I've got the daily stuff, the weekly stuff, the monthly stuff. I've got quarterly and annual. This used to be my employees. Now it's my grandkids. That's once a month visits with each of the grandkids. But we have to hold ourselves accountable and then having that coaching cycle with our leader, right, to continue to advance. I see a lot of people that define leader standard work and they do their best to adhere it. But if you don't have that improvement loop built into it, it's leader standard work as a tool, not leader standard work as a system. And so it's got to have that improvement tool with your one-up to be able to give you some feedback about how you're doing.
I was introduced to a term a few months ago, the cybernetic control system, which, you know, sounded fancy, but it was basically just a term that explains a self-regulating system. I don't know if that's a term that you've ever heard of, but I was just introduced to it a few months ago, but it basically describes almost every self-regulating system. And when I think about my leader standard work and inside our organization, a question I ask myself is how frequently should we audit that standard work and, you know, compare it to those outcomes and like, oh, I have the right standard work or I don't. Do you have a preferred frequency of making changes to that?
I do. You know, obviously, if there are any initiatives that, you know, need to be, if I've got safety, you know, exceptions and things that need to be urgent, obviously, we change it on the fly, you know, at a moment's notice. But if I see sustained patterns over a quarter, as a leader, especially an executive leader, you know, more frequent changes, probably the closer you are to the value added areas, less frequent because the cycles of improvement are longer. They're not as tightly repeated at higher levels in the organization. So you don't want to be too dynamic in changes at the top. You want to see the trends over a quarter and then ask yourself, look, either I'm not adhering to this and things are still happening fine, so maybe it doesn't need to be here. Or I continue to miss this and I'm seeing it in the KPIs. What else do I have to drop so that I can improve my performance, even add more things in this particular category? That's usually how I approach it. The once a year total overhaul, I mean, I do those kinds of things like they do in automotive. If there's stuff that I think could be better across the organization, let's say I'm one of the leaders and I want to make sure that we're all doing similar things as leaders in my responsibility, I'll do model year updates. 26, guys, we're going to all switch. We're going to emphasize these kinds of things. Model year update. Other than that, it's quarterly individual, unless it's urgent.
Yeah, I tend to go with a quarterly from just like, am I reviewing the efficiency, effectiveness of my standard work on a quarterly basis? So it's in my quarterly standard work to say, have I reviewed this and made any changes? So that's a, you know, kind of an example of a frequency, an iteration frequency that I like to put into place. Yep. That's a good one.
I agree.
That's a good one.
I think also as leaders too, and I do miss, being a consultant outside because my feedback loop is not as crisp as when I work inside organizations. But as a leader, I always appreciated the time that, you know, one of my direct reports, we would review their leader standard work. We'd go over, you know, what worked, what didn't work, all of that stuff. But then I would also turn mine to them and I'd say, here's mine. Here's how I did last month. These are the specific tasks that I'm doing to support you. What can I do different? What can I do better to be able to support you? What can we change on my leader standard work to be more supportive of you? And that feedback I found extremely valuable at times and also illustrative of, do you know I'm doing all of these things for you? You know, are you aware of what's happening?
That's a very good thing. Along those lines, one of the questions that I wanted to discuss was, in building a continuous improvement system or program inside of an organization, it's frequently said that you need to have executive or leadership support. I'm curious if you have any advice on how leaders can demonstrate support for those things, you know, at the various levels. I mean, like one-on-one type conversations, like you mentioned, I'm sure is one, but any other advice or thoughts on how to do that as a leader?
Yeah, it's got to be more than support. This is not a spectator sport. This is a player sport. They've got to be involved. They've got to be engaged. They've got to be practicing. No fair for the leader to be standing on the side of the pool showing us all how to swim, right? You got to get in the water. You got to be involved in problem solving that's applicable at your level. You got to be practicing the methods that we say are appropriate for the organization and role modeling all of those behaviors that you're encouraging everyone else to do. So leader standard work, regular coaching intervals, performance management on a cadence that's appropriate, right? And we spend different levels of, depending on what level in the organization you are, the cadence is a little bit different, and also the focus. And so for a lot of the cadences that are very frontline, it's very, very detailed, very focused into those intervals. But further into the future, more of it moves into the cadence and the practice of strategy deployment. As a leader, as we get better in the organization, instead of looking back and seeing what happened last week, what happened last month, what happened last quarter, in traditional organizations, most of the time, that's what we're looking at, what happened. It's rearview mirror kind of stuff, right? We want them looking more through the front windshield. What's coming? How do I prepare? How do I see what's happening? And how do I communicate that to my people? Forward-looking, that's leadership, where we're starting to leave management behind.
So I was at lunch earlier this week with a gentleman who was asking me about AI. You know, like I'm you know, working in technology and connected to this AI thing. I should know about it. Is AI going to have as big as an impact on business society as the telegraph? So I'm curious, Ted, in the work that you're doing, as we talk about creating capacity, there's this idea that AI has the potential to create a whole bunch of capacity. I don't know if you have any thoughts on where AI is going or how companies can be thinking about it. I'm sure that's one of the strategic priorities that's on a lot of people's agenda right now.
It is. And it's, you know, years ago when I was a young engineer, we were looking at robotics and where do I apply automation and those kinds of things, right? And the thing over time, one of those pieces of truth we talk about is that any level of automation needs to be the servant of the people, not the master of the people, right? So when we use AI, when we use some of that automation and robotics and those kinds of things, it's helping people to be able to do more, see more, respond faster, those kinds of applications. I use it with my consulting clients. I've got a municipal city in Illinois that's just doing some amazing things, mid-sized municipal city, and setting up KPIs across public works and economic development and the arena and all of the other functions that they have going. I told them, I said, you know, I can tell you what KPIs you might want to consider, but go to ChatGPT, type it in, ask what are the most common KPIs, pick out the ones that resonate with you, and let's start on those, right? And then we'll line them up as an organization, and we'll start moving forward. Don't wait for somebody to tell you. Don't make me the bottleneck of the operation. You can learn a lot of stuff from AI and not have to ask a consultant.
That's such a good lesson there. You know, don't wait to be told. I think with metrics, I do see a lot of, you know, people get so caught up in measuring the right thing, measuring the wrong thing. It sounds like you have an approach there that you like to take with your metrics, with your KPIs.
It is very much, so much about lean, you know, the agile framework that, you know, has evolved as well. It's less important to be really good. It's more important to get started. It's more important to be on the path, not where you're at on the path. And, you know, because all paths are moving forward if we've got that iterative improvement cycle in place. And so, you know, even this morning in visiting with leaders from that municipal city, they said, we've got almost all of our KPIs, you know, defined for all of the departments. And, you know, they kind of went through that and they said, but there are a few outliers. Should we wait until we get them in place before we start? No, don't wait. Start with what you've had. Put, you know, coming soon on that KPI, and then, you know, do what you can now and start moving forward, and the rest will come. You know, have confidence in the system. It'll come. You'll find it.
I think that's such an important theme there. You mentioned a little bit before about the idea of truth in some of the methods and some of the tools. And I think that this whole discipline of continuous improvement and just the principle of standing on the shoulders of giants, you might say, or just incrementally improving, there's different words and different languages and different methodologies that you know, can be put on it as wrappers. But overall, it's this you know, intrinsic need to improve. And you just touched on something that I think is a really important part of it. To improve, you've got to get started. And the best time to start is usually today. I appreciate that wisdom. Ted, I really appreciate having you here. I am curious. You've got a little quote there behind your head. I wanted to see if we could have you read that to us or tell us what that is.
Yeah, I do. I usually switch a Bible verse every year. This one I've had for a couple of years because I can't seem to find one that fits better. But it talks about be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. And that's from Old Testament. It's from Joshua, right? And it has to do with the 40 years where the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness. And then all of a sudden, the Lord gives them the signal, okay, you can cross the river. It's now time to move forward. And so all of those behavior patterns, all of the things they'd done, now is going to change. Now is going to be different. And for so many of us who've been in organizations or done things differently, you know, now's the time. Move forward.
I think the thing that's interesting about that is, as we're talking about different methodologies, you could put a different, I mean, that concept, I would just summarize that almost as like faith. You have to have faith to move forward with the change. So whether it's a personal change or a change at work, there is that little gap of time between when you think that thing's impossible to when you think it's probable. You have to have that faith. So I think that that's a principle that extends beyond any single religion, that principle of faith, and how important that is for us as humans to have personally, individually in our lives, and also in our work every day, that thing, that change, that idea that we have that we want to try, that can actually work for us.
Absolutely. One of the other things probably worth mentioning is that usually when I start clients on my path to supporting them, we take them somewhere that has a very mature system. Right? Somebody that's been doing this for 2 or 3 decades, take them to those sites, let them see the level of engagement, let them see the performance that's been achieved, all of those kinds of things, because so many times they know the words, but they don't really know what the words look like when they're in action. So by seeing those, the analogy I use is the chocolate cake one. I can describe to you what chocolate cake looks like, tastes like, feels like. It's sweet, smooth, it's rich, it's, you know, but until you have some of your own, and then all of a sudden you start going, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And so then the faith, the stretch of faith doesn't have to be quite as much because I've seen what this might look like. All I have to do is transition that into what might it look like for our organization? You know, what could it be for us? And then that faith to be able to, start moving in that direction.
That's awesome. Well, Ted, I really appreciate your time today and your wisdom and sharing your experiences with us. If somebody wants to connect with you, what's the best way for them to find you?
Well, you can find us on the website, right? It's iversonconsultinggroup.com. You can find me on LinkedIn, Ted Iverson. You know, good ways to do it. Good way to get started. Come with us. Come with us on one of these visits. Come with us on an experience. We call them BPX, a best practice exchange. Come with us and see what really, really good looks like, because there is a level that most organizations never reach. And when you see it, it's like, oh my gosh, this is absolutely incredible. Come with us.
But what kind of companies or industries or people, who does that invitation extend out to there, Ted?
Across all industries. That's the weird thing is, right, the pieces of truth that we've attained. I've worked across almost all industries in my coming on 40 years worth of experience. And so we show some manufacturing. We show some light manufacturing. We show service ops organizations. We show aerospace and defense kinds of organizations, financial organizations. There's a wide variety. My mining clients are happy to share their experiences as well. And, you know, the Shingo awarded sites. So a lot of them are Shingo awarded sites or Shingo prize level kind of organizations. So they are, you know, not only do I say they're good, it's externally validated that these guys are among the best.
Thanks so much for joining us here today.
No problem. Keith, thanks for setting this up and thanks for your efforts to help spread the news. Good stuff.
You bet. This episode is brought to you by KPI Fire. KPI Fire is continuous improvement software. KPI Fire helps you align strategy, drive execution, and engage your people, all in one powerful software platform. So whether you're leading a team or transforming an entire organization, KPI Fire is your partner in achieving breakthrough results. You can learn more at KPI Fire. And if you'd like to suggest a guest or have a question or any other ideas that you'd like to have for an episode, you can reach out to me, Keith Norris, on LinkedIn. And this concludes this episode of KPI Fireside, a continuous improvement podcast. If you've enjoyed today's episode, be sure to follow us on all the socials and share the podcast with friends or colleagues who are as passionate about continuous improvement as you are. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. And until next time, keep driving progress and sparking change.